Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is my good friend, Brian Clark, a retired United States Navy commander who is now with the Hudson Institute think tank, where he is the director of the Center for Defense Concepts and Technology, joining us to discuss the Pentagon's drive for a joint all-domain command and control system, as well as the technologies needed to realize it. Brian, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago. It's great to be on again.
Absolutely. It's tremendous having you on, as always. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. Brian, the focus on JADC2 has been a centerpiece of the U.S. military. That thinking began, obviously, in the Obama administration with former Air Force Chief of Staff General Dave Goldfein being the advocate and the intellectual pillar of that initiative. He was supposed to be chairman. The entire joint force was to adopt it as part of a joint or sort of a backbone of the joint warfighting concept. The 4 years of the Trump administration worked on that, but it looked like, you know, the Navy was going in its own way. The Air Force and the Army were going to kind of do their own thing, but it became something that was somewhat less focused. This administration is looking at what that future looks like. What should JADC2 be? What's the rationale for it? And what does it need to do?
This is a terrific topic. It's very important right now. Obviously, JADC2 is in the center of a lot of the defense news today. So Joint All-Domain Command and Control had a lot of preceding concepts, as you noted, multi-domain operations, multi-domain command and control, the Advanced Battle Management System, ABMS are all tied up in it and preceded it to a degree. What it is today is it's at risk of becoming this construct that everybody connects their program to, but it really doesn't mean anything on its own. And I think the Joint Staff is actively trying to push against that. We did an event last week with General Krall, who's the J6, who was actively pushing the idea that JADC2 is really a decision-making strategy for DoD that supports the joint warfighting concept. And under JADC2, there are some programs that support the decision-making process. So there's communications, there's decision support tools, there are battle management tools, but they're all designed to support this JADC2 decision-making process and strategy, which I think is the right path. And the challenge, though, is defining what it is you're trying to do with your decision-making approach, and then what is the joint warfighting concept you're intended to support? There's some theory of victory that you're intending to direct or your forces toward through your decision-making process, and JADC2 has to support that. And left to their own devices, the services will make JADC2 into just a collection of programs as opposed to a strategy. And they're just going to conduct their priority efforts against it so that they can continue to get money. ABMS is a perfect example of that, where the Air Force has devised the Advanced Battle Management System, which is supposed to be the pipes that connect all the forces to support JADC2. And you're already seeing like everybody's trying to show how their thing is part of ABMS so that they can make sure that it stays funded. So you got this tension that we normally see in bureaucracies between a strategic direction that's going to make some choices about the direction you want to go and the bureaucratic forces that want to take everything that exists today and make it useful in that new set of operations so they can, continue to get funding for their program.
And so what is, one of the few analysts in Washington who actually talks about theories of victory, right? What should the theory of the joint warfighting concept be?
Yeah, so the theory of victory for the joint warfighting concept should be being able to create uncertainty for an adversary such that they are deterred or dissuaded from pursuing aggression. I think that should be kind of the fundamental approach. I think this gets into a discussion you've been having on the program and others have been having about deterrence versus defeat as the mechanism, by which we achieve our objectives. So do we build a force that's able to defeat the Chinese in a large-scale attrition fight, or do we build a force that's intended to deter the Chinese from the things that they might want to pursue and thereby you know, forestall aggression to some later date. And I think the joint warfighting concept should be going after the latter. How do we devise a, how do we organize the force? How do we do command and control of it in such a way that it creates uncertainty for the Chinese regarding their likelihood of success, such that they are dissuaded from pursuing conflict at a particular time, and just continue to push that date out into the future, and thereby contain, if you will, or at least put back pressure on Chinese expansionism, and hopefully get to a point where eventually our allies are able to defend themselves sufficiently that they reach an equilibrium in the Western Pacific. That seems to be the only approach that our fiscal constraints are going to allow us to pursue.
I want to get to those fiscal constraints in a minute, right? Because at the end of the day, real strategy is about making trade-offs, right? I mean, if you're not prioritizing anything, it's not really a strategy. One of the central problems, though, with JADC2, I mean, as you said, right? I mean, it's becoming a little bit of a Christmas tree, and everybody's interpreting it in their own way. One of the central problems with JADC2 is that each of the services is, you know, as you said, right, interpreting it in their own way for their own programmatic needs, effectively, right? Because there doesn't seem to be that sort of unifying vision. Don't all the services have to be aboard? I mean, the way JADC2 sort of developed was the Air Force, and then the Air Force and the Army, and then the Navy sort of being like, we'll get as connected as our existing programs allow, and then eventually hardened into, we're just going to do our own thing and cross-connect with you.
Right.
Is that a functional approach at the end of the day? Does everybody need to be in it, including the Marine Corps, by the way, as we go to much more distributed, smaller penny packet forces that are going to be distributed over vast areas?
Absolutely. I think everybody needs to be in it. And I think the distribution is a key element. So we think that if the joint warfighting concept's design is to, or theory of victory is to, create uncertainty for an opponent, that would be probably via the complexity of our own force, or the adaptability of our own force, the fact that our own force doesn't have a predictable way of configuring itself or a predictable way of operating. You know, that's the way that we're going to create this uncertainty for the Chinese. Their approach of system destruction warfare is based on the idea that they can forecast how the U.S. forces will be composed, what their systems of systems will look like, what their vulnerabilities are going to be, and therefore the PLA can develop a set of countermeasures and approaches that are intended to target our key nodes and our key vulnerabilities and take apart our system of systems before we're able to defeat them in combat. So if we're less predictable, it undermines the ability of system destruction warfare to provide that rapid victory that the Chinese are hoping to pursue. So that in a way, this approach to warfare that the joint warfighting concept could pursue would be a way of turning that disadvantage of being the away team and being up against a really formidable power that's targeting our own capabilities, and turn that into an advantage, because now we are actually taking all of their investment and maybe obviating a lot of it because no longer applies given our unpredictability. And if that's the case, everybody needs to be on board with that overall approach. And therefore, JADC2 needs to provide the decision-making framework that allows you to do this more decision-centric approach to warfare. So if you're trying to create uncertainty for the enemy, how you do that is not by building out a plan and robotically following it, like in some cases we do through the current joint planning process. You've got to leave your options open. So it's an optionality strategy much more than it is a forecast-centric strategy. So that command and control process needs to basically be one where you're always trying to keep your options open as much as possible, which is a very different way of fighting than I think a lot of our military forces are prepared to do. So that's a very different command and control approach. That's what JADC2, I think, is thinking about pursuing and should be pursuing in it to enable this new warfighting concept.
It's creating uncertainty for us at this point, I think, as my producer just joked with us, Chris Cervello is listening in this call, as he often does. And certainly, right, at the end of the day, you want to create more uncertainty for the adversary than you do for yourself at the end of the day, which is something we're getting somewhat expert at, sadly, because of the way that we sort of pursue things. But how, what are the investments, Brian, that are necessary, right? Because we have very, very sophisticated adversaries. They are interested in degrading something like JADC2, right? I mean, because it creates an intellectual dependency of connectivity, which we've had throughout the last 22 decades of warfare, right? I mean, to the point that we weren't even securing our UAV feeds because we assumed, well, there's no way that they're, you know, the adversary is listening to those and, or, you know, or intercepting them. And it turns out that they were for a while. The Russians and the Chinese are looking at degrading and taking and actually dominating the electromagnetic spectrum in right. cyber, as well as then kinetic means to degrade these networks. What are some of the discrete investments we need to be making in order to be able to create what is a resilient, flexible, adaptive, distributed right. network,
right.
the likes of which we just simply don't have now?
So a lot of this involves pushing authorities and command down to lower levels or lower echelons in the organization. You know, so today we try to manage things at the AOC, you know, three-star fleet, you know, COCOM level, or combatant, you know, command component level. And we need to push that down and really embrace mission command and get the commander out in the field the ability to manage his or her forces through decision support tools. So when communications are lost with higher headquarters, that 03, 04 out in the field with a group of forces needs to quickly understand which forces are available to them. So there's investments in communication management tools that allow you to understand which forces am I talking to, what can they do, and what's their availability to support, you know, a mission that I want to do, and then help me walk through COAs that can support the tasks that have been given to me by my higher headquarters that I now can't talk to. Those decision support tools and communication management tools are available today. So there's systems like the Symphony system that L3Harris makes. There's the Dynamo communication management system that DARPA is developing that can help you work through the communication management as you compose your network locally when you lose the connectivity with the higher headquarters. And then there's things like the adapting cross-domain kill chains or RSpace or some other programs that have been developed to do the decision support so that local commander can build a COA without having to have a huge planning staff, you know, like the AOC would have. Not only does this sort of compensate for the impact of jamming and communications breakdowns that are imposed by your enemy, but they also create more uncertainty for the enemy. So this is a way to get to Chris's point about having a more complex and more adaptable force can make it difficult for us to manage. So we need to have the tools given to those local commanders so they can manage that complexity and instead impose uncertainty on the enemy as opposed to imposing it on ourselves.
So how much of an investment are we talking about, Brian? I mean, at the end of the day, we are going to be in a resource-constrained environment. As Mike Mullen told us a couple of weeks ago when he joined us on one of our strategy conversations, right? I mean, $740 billion is an awful lot of money and is sufficient with which to defend the nation. But, you know, at the end of the day, it also demands trade-offs. What's the sort of steady state investment to build these resilient command and control systems that we're going to need, absent which it will be impossible to go up against any sophisticated great power adversary?
Right. I mean, you're talking about investment on the scale of a few billion dollars a year. Right now we spend about, you know, $4 to $5 billion a year on electronic warfare system, electromagnetic warfare systems writ large. And that includes, you know, jammers and communication management and battle management tools. So if you were to increase the amount of money we spend on these decision support and management tools, even a little bit, it's still a relatively small number of dollars in the overall scheme of things. But it makes a huge difference in the ability of the force to impose this uncertainty on an enemy. And if we want to be able to deter a country like China, where we're not going to be able to fight them to the death in a war of attrition in the Western Pacific, we've got to do something else in order to create sufficient difficulties for them that they don't feel confident and the propensity of things is not on their side and might cause them to think twice about initiating hostilities. So the command and control, the C3 world is where we need to be focusing that investment. And then when it comes to the rest of the force, a lot of that can be done by rebalancing. I mean, look at the Marine Corps. It's a great example of a force that is rebalancing towards a more distributed formation, set of distributed formations that are better able to impose a complexity and uncertainty on an enemy, and then create a more resilient structure because it creates more targets that they have to take out now in detail as opposed to taking out in mass. So rebalancing the force to enable it to better support this approach to decision-making or this decision-centric approach to warfare should be essentially zero sum. You should be able to rebalance the force without adding more money to the hardware side and we can add some more money to the software side, if you will, on C3 to allow that force to be managed.
So in order to be able to do this, though, Brian, I mean, don't we need to either scrap or change programs of record to make sure that whatever it is that we're doing is in fact joint?
Yeah, you do. And because, you know, being able to under a concept where you're trying to create uncertainty for your enemy through your own complexity and your own ability to adapt. There's the C2 side, you know, managing the force. And then there's the force design side where, you know, the mix and number of forces needs to change. Because if it's just, if you're just driving around in a bunch of large monolithic multi-mission platforms, that's not very adaptable. It's pretty predictable how you're going to operate. You're very, you know, very defendable. You're pretty well defended and you're pretty formidable from an offensive standpoint, but how you operate is pretty well understood by the enemy. And the Chinese have been preparing for carrier operations and bomber runs, you know, for 20 years. So they know what that looks like. So we're going to have to rebalance away from that if we want to try to create something new that they are not really prepared for. And that means walking away or not walking away, but reducing the investment in some of those, you know, bigger multi-mission platforms and investing more money in smaller, less multi-mission things. And you already see the services doing this, but it's sort of in a lurching response to some gut feeling that they're not moving in the right direction rather than a joint warfighting concept that says, this is the force design approach that you need to take.
The Biden administration is committed to revitalizing the microelectronics industry. As we've seen, industrial output is driven by the availability of computer chips, and the loci that historically was associated with Intel in the United States has begun to shift to Taiwan, to the Netherlands. Bob Work was on last week, and he talked a little bit about that in the context of the AI report that he, Eric Schmidt, and their team put together as part of the National Commission on Artificial Intelligence. We've done this before, right? Specifically in the 1980s, the Reagan administration was so concerned about Japan and its supremacy in microelectronics that we were making targeted investments to rebuild national capabilities that held us in good stead for the past many decades. I know you guys are studying this. Talk to us a little bit about the at least what you're finding now in terms of what a microelectronics roadmap we need is and how that connects back to our first topic, which is national security, right? It's not just an economic security thing. It is a fundamental national security capability.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what we're finding is we need any of our supply chain assessments for the microelectronics industry in particular, but really all of them, need to consider market demand and value added in their calculations. So it can't just be about the producers. It can't just be about the supply side of the supply ecosystem. You got to think about the demand side as well. And we traditionally don't do that. The reason why it's really important in the microelectronics industry is because the government and DoD in particular are very small players in that industry. You are riding on other people's market demand, really. So unless you create a very bespoke facility to build some very specific thing for your military system, you're pretty much riding on the commercial wave of R&D and production. So you got to think about market demand when you start making policies regarding the supply chain. So one thing we're finding that comes out of that idea of looking both at supply and demand as you look at the ecosystem is investments that the government makes, like money we spend on building new facilities, should be focused on facilities that are building that next generation of capabilities where we can hit that, add the value that's going to be able to hit future demand. So we need to be, you know, going to where the puck's going as opposed to where the puck is today. So try to steer our investments towards future capabilities, future technologies, and microelectronics, for example, 3D chips, you know, where you got chips that are stacked on top of each other, chiplets where multiple chips are combined to create a new architecture. You know, that's the direction that microelectronics are going to kind of break past Moore's law's limitations on performance over time, as opposed to throwing government money after the current generation of chip technology, because there's trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines right now that would be more than happy to, you know, go into that business if there was a set of incentives that the government could put in place to make it a little bit more attractive from a profit perspective to do in the United States. So Intel is dropping $20 billion now. They just announced this week they're going to build a new fab in Arizona with private money, you know, with, you know, some government support, some government incentives, but not government money. So that one big takeaway we've had is that the government should be putting its money against future technologies and then using policy to try to drive investment in today's generation of chip making so we can have that capacity in the United States for those chips.
It is a worthwhile investment. And if I was Intel, I couldn't make that investment fast enough, given that their sort of what was regarded as an inassailable market position has, in fact, is being assailed in large part. I mean, I think the Taiwanese being in the vanguard of that, but South Korea is another chip giant. Of course, we mentioned the Netherlands. The administration just, I just want to tie this because I do want to get your sense on the infrastructure measure the president has announced. Obviously, chips, quantum, all of these capabilities are covered in this $2 trillion package. I know there's going to be an enormous amount of horse trading at the end of the day about this. And fundamentally, it is about bridges, roads, and all of that stuff. But from your standpoint, what are some of the other critical national technological investments that need to be in it? Elaine Luria joined us right after your talk, your great conversation with her at the Hudson Institute. And she talked about the importance of actually infrastructure covering military infrastructure, right? That, shipyards and the shipyard in her district, the primary graving dock dates from 1914, for example. I should point out, other docks all around the country are still there. They're just underwater, whether they're in Philadelphia or in Brooklyn. They're perfectly good dry docks. They're just sort of basins with coffee shops around them right now. What are some of the elements you think need to be in this infrastructure measure from a capabilities standpoint?
Yeah, so I think the shipyard infrastructure is a great point in that. I mean, the Navy's got this Navy Shipyard Infrastructure Optimization Plan that's a extremely slow moving effort to improve their infrastructure that could be accelerated substantially, because right now $20 billion is all they're planning to put against a 21 over 20 years. So, they need to, ramp that up substantially, which this bill could help do. I think quantum technology, which you mentioned, that's an area where we need to put significantly more investment, which, in quantum actually isn't that much money. It's, because you get a relatively small amount of money for a relatively big impact on research. But that would be a great area to put more investment in. And that depends on kind of that next generation of microelectronics technology, which is where we should be focusing our government investment. That's, the VC world, the private equity world is not interested in those next generation technologies because the returns are so, for them, distant. 10 years or more is way past their window. So I think, quantum, these next generation microelectronics architectures and chip technologies, that's where we should be putting money so that we're prepared to lead in that area, not just be a player, but actually be the leader. We can get out ahead of where TSMC and Samsung are in those chip technologies. And I think space is the maybe the last one. So right now there's a lot of commercial interest in space. One thing that we're finding talking to some commercial space companies is that business is not is getting saturated, right? There's a lot of people throwing a lot of their own private money in there between SpaceX and Blue Origin and others, in the VC and PE world. But we could find ourselves in a situation where you've got a lot of private companies that are now not really viable over the long term. And the government's going to have to think about, do we step in and make investments here? Do we start to invest in some of our own systems to be able to replace these low Earth orbit systems that are now becoming commercially inviable? So space is probably another area we should be thinking about making investments to secure our access for national security purposes to that domain.
Absolutely. Amen. Brian, thanks so very much for joining us. And I want to assure our audience that there was no April Fool's tomfoolery on this day. We hope everybody has a great April Fool's Day. Thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure and already looking forward to having you back on.
Thanks a lot, Vago. It was great to be here and great to talk to you guys.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.